Hi, everybody. My name is Gavin. I'm an alcoholic. And it's great to be here. I'm also a grateful member of the Al-Anon Family Program. Yes. And a recovering bigot. You know, we don't often talk about bigotry around here, but I'm going to talk about it this morning, and I see some black people here this morning. Yeah. Black is beautiful. And I had an experience. Part of what I do as a recovering priest, as a priest, I do a lot of retreats. I live at a retreat center in California, and that's in a little town called San Juan Bautista. There's an old mission there that's Spanish for St. John the Baptist, San Juan Bautista. I had a man come up to me after Mass a month ago, and he said, "What's the Pope's number?" I thought he wanted to call the Pope. And I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "The Pope, he has a number after his name. What's the Pope's number?" I said, "Oh, our present Pope is Benedict the 16th. He said, now this guy's setting me up, but I don't see it coming. He said, "We had another Pope with a number. He was a wonderful man. John the 23rd, Pope John the 23rd. I said, "Yeah, of all the popes in my lifetime, he's my favorite." He said, "You know what us Mexicans called John the 23rd? I said, "No." He said, "We called him 1, 2, 3. Alcoholics are known to be grandiose, and I can prove that to you, because chapter 5 really appeals to newcomers when they hear that, particularly when they're looking for something to save their life. David, can I borrow chapter 5? Thank you. I've known David for a couple of years, and I get to down here to Sarasota and Tampa once or twice a year. So I have a lot of friends that I know in this room already, and I got a whole bunch of other friends this weekend. You know, when we read this chapter 5, it appeals to grandiose people. And we so treasure this that you may not realize that when we have new... By the way, what's your grandson's name?
Hampton Blake.
Hampton Blake. Where'd he go?
They got out of here.
Oh, that's too bad. He's a newcomer. He's the most important person in this room.
He's got five months sobriety.
5 months sobriety? That's a good start.
5 weeks.
Yeah. You know, how many people here have less than 6 months sobriety? Would you stand? 6 months or less. Thanks for standing up. And you are the most important people in this room. And when you first hear that, you think, whoever says that, he has a screw loose or something. You know, what do you mean I'm the most important person in the world? Because as our speaker Vince last night illustrated so well, we know a lot about you. We may not know the details of your story, but we know your feeling life, what has gone on inside of you. We know a lot of your defects. And when those of us that have been around a little more than 6 months get to talk to you, we realize how precious you are and how in need you are of recovery. And we get to say out loud all the things we dearly believe in. And the beauty of that, you may or may not hear that, but we get to hear it. We get to hear it, and we find out what we really do believe and how much we care about you. So I hope that clears you up. But with this chapter 5, you may not have noticed before, but see the taper? He's got earphones on. You know, these guys do a lot of conferences, and they get bored. And you think he's working. He's listening to the ball game. Ah, okay. Oh, that's great. That really is great. Let me get back to the bigotry and the black thing. And I'm going to be grandiose here. I want to apologize to all you black people for what people with my color skin have done to you throughout history. I did a retreat in Birmingham, Alabama a couple of years ago, and it was 70 recovering alcoholic and Al-Anon members who were all Episcopalians. And I'd done retreats down there twice before for the same group, and I always want to go through that Civil Rights Museum, but it's closed on Mondays. So I went down a day early this time, and I went through the Civil Rights Museum in Birmingham, Alabama, and it's not overly dramatized, but when you see all the abuse lined up one thing after another, it makes you ashamed to be white. And we all participate in that. You know, our defects are handed down generation to generation, unless, because we're all homegrown. And so I'm going to apologize to you people of color on behalf of all the white people here. Hope you white people don't mind. I'll get into the kind of bigotry that I'm still recovering from a little later, but it doesn't have anything to do with race. My dad was a general contractor, and he hired men from all different races and nationalities. And when I was in high school, he hired me each summer, and he didn't cut me any slack. And these guys were my buddies and my friends. And I just see people of color, you know, they're all shades. As human beings. And that's a great gift, because not everybody sees other people like that. So I hope I'm going to make the point that we're all recovering bigots, and many bigots don't realize they're bigoted. So that'll give you a new category to examine your conscience about, or when you take an inventory. I'll give you an example. It's not as heavy as the race thing, but I cannot stand people who go in the 10 or less line at the market with 25 things. I just go ballistic inside. And when I was 5 years old, my dad had a big job in Morgantown, West Virginia. That's where I first ran into bigotry. I was in the basement of Penny's department store. And I hadn't been to school yet, but my mother was a teacher, so I already learned how to read. And all of a sudden, I'm having all these adults yelling at me. And there were two water fountains. One was white and one was colored. And I went to the colored one. I never had colored water. You know? I wonder what that tasted like, see? But that really upset some of the adults. And it all had to be explained to me. On that retreat, there was an Episcopal priest who made the retreat, and he told me that a friend of his, I don't know if it was an industrial accident or agriculture, anyway, the guy cut his leg off somehow, and they got a tourniquet on his leg, what was left of it, and stopped the bleeding. So they loaded him and the other part of his leg in the back seat of this priest's car, and he drove to the county hospital in Birmingham, and they wouldn't admit the man because he was black. And he died in the back seat of that car. Thank God we've made a little progress. Jeez. We're all brothers and sisters. And we really learn that when we get into Alcoholics Anonymous. Because many of the people who have helped me the most in recovery are people that belong to different churches or whose spirituality is different than mine. I had a guy that didn't like me. And every time, I'm not perfect, and I don't ever want to be. I know some people who think they are. They don't have what I want. I was kind of mischievous because I knew this guy didn't like me. And when he'd be in a meeting, I'd sit next to him. And I'm not proud of that, but I used to do that. You know? And he'd get up and move. You know? And people started to catch on to that. And One day he said, "I want to talk to you." First time he ever talked to me. He said, "Let's go out back." I thought he wanted to fight. He said, "I belong to such and such a religion." And he mentioned the religion. And he said, "We believe that all priests are devils in disguise. And we're not supposed to talk to you. But I'm going to talk to you, even though it's against my religion. Because I want you to know I'm praying for you every day. You are so screwed up. You know, you need all the prayers you can get." But I said, "I'll take your prayers." You know, and he and I became great friends, thanks to the program. There are some people here who are my age or older. I want to announce to you that besides being alcoholics or alanoids, you have another disease, and you may not know it. It's called hardening of the categories. You know, we just have certain ways of looking at things. We have certain labels that we like to put on things, and when some new reality comes along, it doesn't fit in any of those pigeonholes or categories or labels, but we try to force it in there. I see some CDs out there of Burns B. He's a great speaker. He's a great member of the program. And Burns likes to describe that defect this way. He says, "My defect is square peg," or wait a minute, yeah. "Square peg, round hole, bigger hammer." You know? I'm going to take this new reality and force it into one of the categories. So I'm doing something today that really shocked some of my friends, because I've done retreats here in Tampa for recovering people. By the way, there's no such thing as an AA retreat or an Al-Anon retreat, because that's a violation of traditions. Alcoholics Anonymous, Al-Anon, is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, retreat movement. But you can have a retreat for recovering people, and they're all members of AA or Al-Anon, and that's okay. And I like to point that out, because we're a bunch of egomaniacs. We would have blown this thing up years ago if it wasn't for those 12 traditions. However, no matter how much I talk about that, people are still going to call them AA retreats or Al-Anon retreats. But at least I want to honor the traditions. I have a thing about being addressed by title in AA meetings. And I don't like to be called Father here. And some people have been chewing on me recently, saying, "You must be ashamed to be a priest." No, I'm not. I'm happy to be a priest. I have a great life. You know, I go all over the country and Canada doing retreats, a lot of them for 12-step people, in parish missions, and I get to live in California. It's not a bad life. So I'm trying to address issues related to inflexibility or hardening of the category. So when Craig asked me how I wanted to be on the program, he said, "Do you want to be identified as a priest?" I said, "Yeah, go ahead." So I'm practicing. It'll probably be the last time I do it. But I have an inflexible part of me, and I don't like that. And Vern Johnson, who wrote a wonderful non-conference approved book called I'll Quit Tomorrow. Isn't that a great title for a book? Vern used to like to say that alcoholics are rigid. Oh, we're offended. You know, but if your alcoholism develops, you disappear for 3 or 4 days, they don't come looking for you. They know what bar you're going to be in after 3 days and what bar stool you're going to be in. You think you're a free spirit because you went to Las Vegas and somehow you got home, but you're on your bar stool. And for those of you who are old timers, you may not realize it, but when you go to meetings, you always pick the same seat. Yeah. Sometimes somebody sits in my seat and I get a resentment. So I try to move around. So that's why I'm not embarrassed to be a priest. But we don't use titles around here. In my home group, when I first joined in Phoenix, Arizona, a friend of mine from Denver came. And someone recognized him as a physician. His first name is Blair. So this guy's saying, oh, you got Dr. Blair here tonight. Dr. Blair is a wonderful physician and all of that. And he was a little antsy being recognized by title also. And of all things, the topic of that discussion meeting was, would you still go to meetings if they had a pill that would cure alcoholism? Kind of a unusual topic, but it turned out to be pretty good. And when it got Blair's turn, he said, I'm interested in the topic that you chose for this meeting. And part of my career as a physician has been involved in research, so I know a lot about brain chemistry. And I think that perhaps someday they will have a pill that will cure alcoholism. Man, it got quiet. He said it's probably 200-300 years down the road. He said, but I hope it doesn't happen in my lifetime, because if they had a pill that would cure alcoholism, I'd take too many. And for you new people, that's what we're addicted to. We're addicted to more. More alcohol, more drugs, more status, more excitement. Alcoholics are all excitement junkies. And my first sponsor, who was a very dear, loving, wonderful, wise man, his name was Les. One day he said, all alcoholics crave excitement. I think I was sober 2 or 3 years, and I was in that stage when I wanted to find my sponsor wrong about something. I can tell some of you know about that place. And so I started looking for a really dull, boring alcoholic just to prove Les wrong. And I found her. And she didn't know what I was doing. I asked her, I said, by the way, do you have a very exciting life? And she said, honey, you don't know what I do for a living. I said, yeah, that's right. I don't know what you do for a living. She says, I'm a successful writer of pornography. There goes that theory. The short version of my story is the one I'm going to give you today. The long version lasts 70 years, and you don't want to go through all of that. Short version is I used to drink alcohol and do stupid things, and now I don't drink alcohol. See, but the beauty of that is when I do stupid things today, I catch on quicker, and I can admit that I'm wrong. I love that step. I love admitting I'm wrong, because I'm wrong a lot. I don't intentionally be wrong, but to admit it is freedom. Oh, it's wonderful. A lot of us spend a lot of our life walking around pretending we got it all together. Nobody has it all together. We all make mistakes. You want a church category? The Baptists are right. They think we're all sinners. You know, we all miss the mark. That's what that word sin really means. You know, you have a bow and arrow and you're looking at a target and the arrow goes over here somewhere. I made a serious mistake this morning. I missed the dry cleaning run yesterday, so this is pretty wrinkled. There's a nice steam iron in my room, and it didn't have any instructions, so I thought, thought I better quit. You know, I should have asked for help yesterday and figured out how to use that thing. You know, when I first came to AA, I thought someone would have a magic wand, and they'd wave it over me, and I would instantly become sober and serene. And that hasn't happened. This is for you Harry Potter fans. This is a wizard's wand. It makes noise. $4.95 Target. And I also thought you were going to lend me money and probably take the shirt off your back and give it to me. Don't worry about it. It's wrinkled already. I spoke at an AA camp out in California last weekend, and a gal had a shirt that I really admire. And I said, where would you get a shirt like that? And she says, well, I think they sold out of all of them. And She disappeared. About 10 minutes later, she came back wearing another shirt, and she gave me this one. So somebody gave me this shirt off their back, but I had to buy the wand, $4.95. $4.95, Kmart, what a bargain. Well, I don't have any doubt that I'm an alcoholic. Let me qualify as an alcoholic. When I first went to Phoenix, I was in charge of a youth group, and it's hot in Phoenix. It's not humid, but it's hot. And one of the things the kids love to do is float down the Verde River. That's about 40 miles from town. So I borrowed a school bus, loaded it up with kids and half a dozen or eight chaperones, and we went out to the Verde River, and I dumped the chaperones and the kids and the inner tubes in the river, and I drove downstream and parked the school bus where the kids were going to come by about 4 hours later. And all of a sudden, I was terribly hungry. I was so hungry. And I knew what I was hungry for. I love popcorn. So I went on a popcorn run. And I must have gone by a half a dozen supermarkets and convenience stores until I got in downtown Scottsdale, Arizona, at a bar called Lulabelle's, where they had a big bowl of free popcorn on the bar. Now, some of you are seeing through this already. Would you stand up? You and I'd make a good before and after picture. Yeah. That's great. I wasn't hungry. There was food in the back of the bus. I thought I was going on a popcorn run. I needed a drink. And I didn't know it. The next thing I remember, Vince talked about blackout drinking. I woke up in my own bed at home. And the sun was coming up. And I'm thinking, oh my God, those kids. I wonder if they got home. And the second thought was, oh, I'm going to be in trouble now because they're going to snitch. You know what? Those kids loved me so much, they all made up some kind of story, and I didn't get in trouble. I'm an alcoholic. I was stationed in Phoenix for many years. My parents lived in Tucson, 140 miles apart. There was a... In those days, they didn't serve any alcohol on the Pima Reservation. But there was a bar just off the edge of that. This is where the freeway came through. One of my favorite bars. And I was going either to Tucson or Phoenix, and I stopped there one night. And there was a pool table in that bar. And a woman came in and caught her husband with his girlfriend. They were in a booth, kissy face, and the wife went nuts. And she's picking up the pool balls off the pool table and heaving them at her husband and this other woman. And she had an arm. I mean, she broke glasses and bottles behind the bar. And in about 15 seconds, there are a dozen of us out on the street. When I remembered, I left my drink on the bar. So I went back inside, dodging all this artillery, rescued my drink, and joined my friends on the street. Social drinkers don't do things like that. Only an alcohol would find that drink so valuable. So I hope that qualifies me as an alcoholic. Couple of things. I want to tell you my favorite story. It's not a humorous story, but it's my favorite story. I've been a circus fan since I was 5 years old. One of the times I come to Florida every January is spending 5 days with about 20 other people who are like myself that are chaplains to circuses, because they don't get to go to church on Saturday or Sunday because they're always performing. And that's a great life. It's the only way I'd get in the center ring, you know, which is a circus fan's dream. And another thing you might not know unless I told you is that shortly after I was ordained a priest, I got a job working for the Air Force, greeting our wounded returning from Vietnam. Maybe some of you fall into that category. And they were all flown into Travis Air Force Base in California. That's where I was. And we had them a day or two or three until if they were well enough or not shot up too bad, to put on a smaller flight to get to a hospital, military or veterans, near their family. Dave's a veteran. I've known him for a couple of years. And he'll enjoy one of these stories I'm going to tell right now, because he has other loyalties besides AA. That was a great job. And as soon as the troops came in, they all came in on stretchers, in racks, on C-141s, Starlifters. And they'd put them on a bus that had a rack on it, and they'd get them into the hospital beds. And all the paperwork would be at the nurse's station. And so what my job was to be everybody's chaplain. I said, I'm Father Gavin. I represent all the chaplains on base. And I had to ask them their religion. I said, what's your religion? And, I didn't realize I'm going to do this. But this man I'm going to tell you about was black, too. Oh, I love telling this story. His name was Willie. He was a black Marine sergeant. And I'm in this room with four troops in it, and I'm talking to the fellow army person diagonally opposite where Willie was, and he'd been shot across the chest a lot, and the nurse is putting some solution on the dressing, so when she changes the dressing, it isn't going to rip and hurt, and he's giving her a bad time. He's got a big, loud mouth. And he said, don't baby me, rip that sucker off. And she said, yes, sir. And she goes, rip. And all the rest of us kind of went like, ugh. But Willie surprised us all, because he just vaulted out of bed, looked in the mirror and said, that isn't too bad. You know, he's looking at meat that's all torn up and a couple of places where there used to be ribs. He said, put a Band-Aid on that and help somebody that needs you. I like Willie. I really like Willie, and I get to talk to him, and I go through my regular drill. We're glad you're home and you're safe and you're getting good medical care. Thanks for what you did for your country and for some other people. I'm Father Gavin. I represent all the chaplains on base. What's your religion? You know what he said? The Marine Corps. There's one of them right there. He's got those Marine stickers all over his car, his notebooks. Probably has a tattoo with Semper Fidelis on it somewhere. Don't take your shirt off. So no sooner had he said the Marine Corps, he said, oh, sir, I'm out of line. I didn't mean to be disrespectful. It's just I've never been in a church. He must have been a weightlifter. He said, wouldn't I look funny in a choir robe? And I'm thinking, yeah, you'd look out of place. And then he said something that really touched me. He said, but I believe in God. God's my buddy. I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for God. I talk to him all day long, and he talks to me. Wow. I'm in the midst of my alcoholism, embarrassed, hoping. I didn't know I was an alcoholic then. I thought I was crazy. And I was. And I was afraid the Air Force was going to find out they had a lunatic working for them. And I was so full of fear about that. And Willie had the good stuff. Willie had a personal relationship with God, something I did not have at that time. And Willie had what I wanted. We talked an hour. Guess who ministered to who then? Yeah. And he was around for the next 2 days. So I spent 3 hours with Willie, and we called each other for a while and then lost track of each other. But that kicked my Catholic narrow-mindedness about it being the one true church in the butt. Because here is a man who was spiritual. He had a personal, real, loving relationship with God. And I wanted what Willie had. And I had no idea I was going to find it here. So you know that I worked with the wounded. You know I love circuses. Went to my first circus when I was 5 years old. I went to a dozen of them last year. I can't get enough of that. One day, somebody came to me, and because this man knew that I worked with the wounded, he said, "Do you think there are atheists in foxholes?" And we talked about that. Now, prior to that, I prayed to every odd, you know, saints in the Catholic Church are specialists. St. Jude is the patron of hopeless cases. St. Swithin is the patron of the twitchy and nervous. You know, I prayed to both of those guys. And the my insanity kept getting worse. I was so mad at the Catholic Church. And I self-diagnosed myself. Now, I think I'm insane, right? Mentally ill. And I came up with the diagnosis that I suffered from excessive guilt. And I said, well, where did I learn all that? So I figured it out. It was those nuns that taught me how to feel guilty. I have said terrible things about nuns. Somebody remembers me saying, I don't remember it, but he remembers me saying that anything ever got me in trouble was taught to me by a nun. You know, we project our pain on other people, and we blame them for our problems. I'm still making amends to nuns. Those are heroic ladies. They're hard work, and up in my church, they're treated as cheap help. They don't get a lot of thanks. But I've met some wonderful, wonderful women who are nuns. Anyway, so we talked about atheists and foxholes. I don't remember much about that. But prior to that, I was so mad at the Catholic Church. I didn't know I was an alcoholic, but I knew I was spiritually sick. So I'd have the early mass on Sunday, get dressed up in a business suit and a tie, and I'd go to different Protestant churches looking for a different spirituality. Now, if you're getting paid to be a Catholic chaplain and you're hanging out in Protestant churches, that doesn't help the guilt either. Because that was on company time. And I think I went to 4 different churches, and I wasn't any happier there than I was in the Catholic Church. Didn't have anything to do with those churches. Had to do with the fact I'm an alcoholic and I'm still drinking. And so this guy talks to me about atheists, and I'm thinking, wow, atheists, I bet they don't feel guilty. So I had a whole new program revealed to me. I decided to be an atheist. I did. Why? So I could get rid of that guilt. So I could be a better chaplain. Oh, I was so whacked out. I used to pray that I would be a good atheist. You know, go figure. And there's a lesson there. When you're in a lot of pain, when I'm in a lot of pain, we don't hook things up. And that's why we need trusted friends in the fellowship and sponsors who could hook the dots up and make sense out of the pieces that we have compartmentalized. I love telling that story because we all focus on one part of our life when we're hurting. And we usually... You know, I've done a lot of, I don't do much counseling anymore, but I used to do a lot of it. And one of the things they teach you in counseling school is that a major part of most people's problems is their solution to the problem. That's worth knowing about. So all the more reason to practice being flexible. And I hope you call me Gavin instead of Father Gavin. Anyway. So you know I tried being an atheist. You know I love circuses. I was sober about a year, and I was speeding in a residential neighborhood. Oh, by the way, I thought California had crazy drivers. I live near Highway 101, and the speed limit is 65. The average speed is 80. If you're doing 80, you get passed a lot. And then I found, what is it, Dale Mabry? Jeez. That's a racetrack. I think some of those people don't know where they're going. They just know they're late. So here comes the story. I nearly hit this little boy on a bicycle. And I was so shocked. I got the car stopped because I knew what almost happened. And I knew it would have been my fault. So I'm looking in the rearview mirror, and the little boy, I know I didn't hit the little boy, but he's looking at me, and he wobbled around on his bicycle and he fell off. So I went running back to help him. And if I read the body language correctly, I think he figured I missed him with the car, now I'm going to run him down on the truck. Because he hopped on that bike and he was gone. You know, I never saw him again. And I am a mess. I'm in the middle of the street babbling and crying. And we think of women being hysterical. I know how to do it. You know, I was such a mess, I couldn't get the car started. And this was before cell phones, so I called my sponsor. I walked a couple of blocks, found a payphone. I said, "Les, there's something wrong with me." He said, "I know." I said, "Well, tell me what it is." He said, "Let's get together, we'll talk about it." So we got together, and he said, "Gavin, your problem is you believe too much." Oh, I was deeply wounded. I thought he was making fun of this spirituality I was working so hard at. And he saw me kind of freak out, and he said, "I guess you don't understand. Let me tell you a story. Let me tell you a story about a circus." Ha ha. He knew how to get my attention, huh? He says, suppose you and I go to a circus, and we're sitting in the front row, and a performer comes out, and he climbs up a ladder. He gets 50 feet up in the air, and I've never heard this story before, and he's going to walk across that thin steel wire, 50 feet in the air, all the way from that side of the arena to this side. And he makes it, and everybody applauds. And then he picks up a wheelbarrow, and he's going to push the wheelbarrow back across that high wire. And that looks terribly frightening. And you know a lot of circus people, and you poke me in the ribs and you say, "Don't worry about it. This guy does this twice a day. He's done it for 20 years. He's not going to fall." He said, "Okay, Gavin, you believe he's not going to fall. But don't tell me you really trust that man until you get up there with him and sit quietly in the wheelbarrow while he pushes you across." Now, we call that faith. You don't have any because you're full of belief. Now, there's nothing wrong with belief. We can do belief standing up here, sitting down there. We can do it with our brain, with our mouth. We do faith by acting on our belief. Belief is wonderful. Faith in what you believe in, or action, put it in program words, in what you believe in is better. I love telling the wheelbarrow story. And you don't have to quote me, it's your story now. It really catches some people. There are a whole lot of people who go to church that don't have any faith. They got a lot of belief, but they don't act on the belief. And I have a suspicion that would be almost any church. So I like to talk about the God of my experience, not the God of my training. I've had a lot of training. I've been to school a lot. I have a degree in philosophy. You know what that was worth? That allowed me to lose arguments in bars using bigger words. So I like to talk about the God of my experience. And my spiritual experience started one night, and I looked it up. I was in, Friday I was in Sarasota with some circus friends, and the Ringling Museum has a lot of artwork, but it also has beautiful circus displays, and they have an archives. And I looked up in White Tops magazine, 1969 edition, I think, and it talks about I used to do magic as an entertainer. I'm a retired magician, so don't get. I've got a wand. In the old days, one of my favorite effects was called a zombie ball. It's an aluminum ball about this big. It's on a little pedestal. And you take a piece of bigger than this, a piece of cloth, and you show that there's nothing on either side. And then you put that over the zombie ball, cover it up, and the ball rises. And then it kind of gets up to the top of the cloth, and then it disappears. and it shows up over your shoulder and behind your knee, and then it disappears again, and it starts taking off, and you have to catch it with that cloth. This was, I've been sober. Oh, by the way, you don't have to work tomorrow. Tomorrow is my AA anniversary. That's why you don't have to work. Today I'm 38 years sober. Hopefully that'll change tomorrow. And I mention that not to show off, because I give God and you people a lot of credit for that. All I did was show up. It's a little stuffy in here. Some people are kind of nodding out, so why don't you stand up? And while you do that, I'm going to ask this lady to teach us how to say with our hands, God bless you. Okay? This will change the mood.
You want the real God bless you?
Yeah.
God
bless
you.
Let's do it again. God bless you. Great. Thank you. Yeah. That kind of gets the body moving a little bit. I have a wonderful friend here who came up from Naples. You want to stand up, Joe? Joe's a massage therapist. And, he's really good at massage, and I might as well teach you this. I thought of it while we were learning how to say God bless you. I am the founder and director of an organization that teaches people how to be, what do you call these guys in the spa? Physical trainers? Is that what you call them?
Personal
trainers. So I'm going to certify all of you to be personal trainers. It only takes 2 minutes of couch potatoes. Couch potatoes need exercises, but they're really out of shape. So let's see. Raise your right hand like this. Can you do this? I know it takes effort. Can you do that? Great, you're doing good. Let's try it with the other hand. Left hand. I don't want to wear you out. Now see if you can do this. See, and after you get good at this, you can do it like this. You know, exercises, exercises. We must do our exercises. And I didn't come prepared to do this today, but then you tell them that it's good to do some weight training, not just the aerobics. And you don't have to look very far for the weights, because they're handy. So that's when I pick up a bag of potato chips and a bag of Cheetos for the weight training. There are two priests who are close friends of mine who both do retreats in this area. And they're two of my favorite retreat facilitators. So I'll mention their names. Terry R., he's not been down here before, and Tom W. Yeah. So if you see those names on a retreat flyer or hear about it, go to those retreats. They're terrific guys. And they like to be called Father Terry and Father Tom. But we're friends. I'm given an hour and a half to talk. I'm at the 1 hour mark right now. I'm probably going to share about 20 more minutes. You've heard my favorite story? I'll tell you how I got here. And I looked up the date in the archives at the Circus Museum at the Ringling, John and Mabel Ringling Museum in Sarasota, Friday. And it was either June or, I have it written down, it's either June or July 21st, 38 years ago, or 39 years ago. And the performance director of Ringling Brothers that year, Bob Dover, took a liking to me. And he told everybody on the show it was okay for me to be around, even in the backyard, the private areas. That's a circus fan's dream. Now, I'm an alcoholic, and I don't know it, and I'm drinking. And I'm getting in the circus twice a day for nothing. That's wonderful. And some of the people were retiring that year. That's the last year there was one Ringling show. Now they have a red unit and a blue unit. And they put one show out each year, and they stay out for 2 years. So they play in Sarasota. What's the name of that big amp? Huh?
Roberts Arena.
Roberts Arena, yeah. And that's where they do their first show. So it's really rough, and it's not polished. And it's in January. And then they stay out for 2 years. A week ago I said mass for Ringling Brothers Red Unit that's been out a year and a half in San Jose, and that's really polished. They have a truck show now called the Gold Unit. All three of them are wonderful. Anyway, some people were retiring that year, and I wanted to visit with them before they left. So I went flying down to the railroad track in my car, and if I hadn't drank so much and been in such a hurry, I would have noticed that this vacant lot that I parked in had some weeds about this big growing tall, I think it was grass, and it obscured an abandoned irrigation ditch that I didn't know about. So I drove my car into this hole in the ground, and it's vertical. You know, the back half of the car is standing up in the air, and it's right by a busy street. So a crowd gathered to see how this car, I wouldn't hurt, to see how this car got standing on its radiator. So I know I can't get out of there by myself. So I went up to the train, and I went to somebody with the show, one of the workmen, and I said, "My car's in a ditch." I said it alcoholically, like I didn't have anything to do with it. Isn't that interesting? My car's in a ditch. And then the Al-Anons will understand this. I said, "We are going to have to get it out." And he said, "Nothing to it, I'll be back in a little bit." I thought he'd come back with a tractor or a forklift. He came back with Hugo Schmidt, who had the elephant act. And Hugo had his favorite elephant, Targa. And when Targa showed up, the crowd got really big. And it made the newspaper. Ponderous pachyderm rescues portly priest. I added the portly part. But there must have been 200, 250 people there. And they put a work harness on Targa. She took a couple of steps backwards. The car popped out of the hole. And everybody claps and whistles and cheers. And then it got dead silent. And we all heard a little boy say, "Mommy, Mommy, did you see the elephant pull the drunk's car out of the ditch?" Oh. I wanted to kill that kid. But there were all these witnesses. I was embarrassed. So I went home, and I'm drinking in the dining room. And I remember I had a big coffee cup full of scotch. I didn't want the priest I lived with to know that I drank. We're the last people to catch on. Someone wrote a book. It's not a good book about alcoholism. It had a great title. It's called "The Secret Everyone Knows," except us. So I want oblivion. I'm embarrassed. And you know what happened? I can't explain it physiologically. I didn't get oblivion. I didn't pass out. I got clarity. Oh, my God, I didn't want clarity. And I'm thinking, this is an impossible day. I couldn't park in a ditch, not with my great skill. An elephant sure as hell didn't pull me out. Someone with a circus wouldn't turn down money. And those impossible things all happened. This is dramatic, but it's the truth. The next thought I had was, if these impossible things could happen, then I could be an alcoholic. Wow. I'd never thought of that. No one had ever called me that. So I had a favorable impression of AA because of the miracle it worked in a couple of friends' lives. So I called one of them up at midnight, and I'm crying, and he doesn't know who I am. And he says, "Oh, Gavin, is that you?" I said, "Yeah, it's me." He said, "What's the matter?" And I couldn't say the word alcoholic. Huh? I said, "I think I'm one of you." And, you know, that was the lowest I'd ever got in my life. But it got worse because you know what Larry said? "Terrific." Oh. Yeah. And I call myself this awful thing, and he's getting off on it. You know? He said, terrific, because he knows that when someone who has an alcohol problem asks for help, that's the golden moment. And that was in June or July. I think it was July. I didn't get to treat this. This is alcoholic, too. I didn't get to treatment until September 3rd, tomorrow. And you know why it took so long? I had to do research and find the best treatment place. And while I was researching, I got to keep drinking. Okay, but September 3rd, 68 is the sobriety date. Went to a place called Guest House, and it's for Roman Catholic priests and brothers. Saved my life. I was there 5 months, and then they weren't too sure whether they were going to let me go or not. But I'm glad I was there and there all that time. I visited every year to Guest House, and I was sober 3 or 4 years, and the head counselor says, we have 3 priests here in treatment who have formed a little clique, and they're totally alcoholic. You know, we've got all kinds of information on them, but they don't believe they're alcoholic, and they reinforce each other. They go to a meeting and they hear about somebody being in jail. And they say, oh, I've never been to jail. I'm not an alcoholic. And the other two say, that's right. That's right. You're not an alcoholic. So if you can address that in any way in the talk that you're going to share with the men, I wish you'd do it. So I thought I had a pretty good idea. I said, you identify not with the specifics of your drinking career, but with what happens inside of you. And I used to do talks to the general public about alcoholism. And I'd have a question and answer period, and I did pretty good with that, but there was one question that would come up occasionally that I hated, because I didn't know how to answer it. Someone would say, are all alcoholics con artists? You know, when you think of a con artist, you think of somebody consciously being manipulative or in lying. We don't do it consciously. We do it as a reflex to protect the belief that we have it's okay for us to keep drinking. That's what that's about. I know how to talk to Al-Anons and alcoholics about that. I said, not all alcoholics are con artists, but we are talented. We are highly adept at subtly adjusting the truth. See, we adjust a little bit here, a little bit here, a little bit here. By the time we get down here, it has nothing to do with anything that happened back here. That's called dishonesty. There's a stronger word. It's called lying. And we disapprove of liars. Oh, I borrowed this from Dave. I forgot I was going to do this. We talk about the impossible things we ask the newcomers. Now, I know this is sacred, but listen to what we ask of these people. There's some people... those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Jeez, this guy can't even, the newcomer. I think it's great he made it to the parking lot. You know, found the meeting. If you're willing to go to any length, that applies to ego, huh? Yeah, I'm ready to do the whole thing. Huh? Our stories, we decided if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length, you're ready to take certain steps. In all of the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless. Try that with a newcomer. Yeah. Now just be fearless, will you? Jeez. From the very start, like right now. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas until we let go. Absolutely. Wow. We're asking newcomers to do this stuff. There is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measure to avail nothing. The new alcoholic is thinking, they ought to avail half.
Yeah.
That isn't fair. We ask his protection and care with abandon, right? Complete abandon. The ego loves these exaggerated words. And then the steps, for example, step 6, we were entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character. Did I leave a word out?
All.
Yeah, all. We were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. And the word all comes up in other steps too. You get the idea? So we ask the newcomer all these impossible things, and then we get to the best part. We say, no one among us has been able to do this. We're not saints. And that's kind of the theme for maybe the next 10 or 15 minutes that I want to develop. Thank God for defects. Defects prove that we're human. And the God of my experience loves human beings. And the God of my experience knows that I'm not perfect. You're getting a lot of Catholic stuff this weekend. There's some people here who studied the Baltimore Catechism. This is a test. See if you remember this. Why did God make you? Very good. To know, love, and serve Him in this life and be happy with Him in the next. Remember? Okay. What are the four marks of the Catholic Church? Step two says we're insane. It didn't say we're retarded. The four marks of the church are Holy Roman Catholic Apostolic. Remember hearing that? That's triumphal. That's bragging. I'll mention four other marks of the church. It's human. It's fallible. That means it makes mistakes. It's sinful. And it's unfinished. Those are four other equally true things about this particular church. And I hope nobody sends the bishop a CD of this. But that speaks to my imperfection. There's a man who used to go to meetings in St. Louis when Joe and I were both back there, Stephen H., and he's somewhere in Florida, I don't know where. But Steve, every morning, thanks God for his powerlessness. Whew! What a stretch. I know Stephen's right. I don't thank God for my powerlessness all the time, but I thank him for some of my defects. And this is AA heresy, but it's my belief. You know, if you become entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character, and you humbly ask them to remove them all, and God doesn't remove them all, a lot of people think they've failed. It doesn't say God's going to remove them all. If anybody ever had all their defects removed, they'd be perfect, and they would not fit in our group. Yeah. So we're klutzes. And thank God for that. Otherwise, we'd be playing God. When I first got sober, Bill Wilson, one of our co-founders, was still alive. And I tried to meet him twice, and it didn't happen. And I was really sad about that, but I'm happy now that I never met Bill Wilson, because if I had, I'd be standing up here and telling you, when Bill and I talk. But I was in Hawaii conducting a retreat one time, and somebody let me a condominium for a week. That was wonderful. And about 2 days, Joel appreciate this, about 2 days before I was going to go back to Missouri, I got depressed. Probably because I was going back to Missouri. And I was in a black hole. So I went to Walden's Books in downtown Honolulu, and I'm in the computer section looking for a book to cheer me up. See, I've not recovered real well. You know, maybe find an exciting new spreadsheet or something. I don't know. And misfiled in the computer section is a book called Grateful to Have Been There. And it's by Nell Wing. Nell Wing was Bill Wilson's last secretary. She was AA's first archivist. And I did a retreat in Mission, British Columbia. And an old-timer who had over 50 years, George S., well, he's dead now, so he can use his last name, George Strachan, was a friend of mine. And he was there, and he took me home to meet his new wife. And George says, now, that's not conference-approved because Nell Wing was not an AA, okay? But she wrote a book called Grateful to Have Been There. And I grabbed that book. I bought that book, went down the beach, sat under a tree, and read it cover to cover and cried through a lot of it. So it's written by a sweet little old lady and a great archivist or historian, so it's accurate. And you can get that and have the bookstores order it for you. Grateful to Have Been There by Nell Wing. I may be wrong on the number, 18 years of association with Bill and Lois. And George tells his new wife, Gavin really likes Nell's book. And she says, oh, that's great, let's call her. Oh, my God, she's still alive. You know, I thought she ran around with Abraham and Moses and that crowd. And I'm sure I sounded like a teenage girl talking to a rock star. I go, yes, 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 yes. And she says, you ever come to New York City? And I said, yeah, I'm going to be there in a couple of months. She says, here's my phone number. Call me and we'll have dinner. Wow. So I got to meet Nell Wing. And then she got her back up. She wouldn't let me pay for dinner. She said, Lois gave me money for special occasions. And this is a special occasion, so let Lois buy our dinner. Yeah. And then the next time I was in New York City, I got to drive Nell Wing to East Dorset, Vermont, where Bill and Lois grew up. And we met a dear friend of mine who's now deceased, Joni Bloomfield, whose first sponsor was Bill Wilson. Joni came down from Toronto. Nell came up. I drove Nell from New York City to Vermont. I was nervous. I got this treasure in the car with me. But she was like a little girl, you know. Oh, look at that barn with all those flowers around. Let's stop and look at the flower. So we had a great time. And then Eileen, who was the, I don't know what the title was, well, let's just say president of the Stepping Stones Foundation for a number of years. That's the home that Bill and Lois had the end of their life. And Eileen never met Bill or Lois, but she knew a lot about them. She drove up. So I shut my mouth the 3 days I was at the Wilson House in East Dorset, Vermont, and just listened to those ladies. And they talked as much about Lois as they did about Bill. And the two of them that knew Bill and Lois disabused me of the fact that Bill Wilson was terribly grandiose. They said he was really grandiose, but he's also a very humble man. So isn't that interesting? Two sides of the same thing. And I would have not known that unless I'd been there. In 1955, at the International Convention in St. Louis, Bill ramrodded the 12 traditions through, and maybe that wasn't at that convention. I think it was, though. But anyway, whether it was or wasn't, that's when he turned over the governance of AA to a board rather than him being the guru. And he took a symbolic step down off the stage. Nell said it took him several more years to take the last step, because we kind of hang on to things. But those ladies talked as much about Lois being special as Bill. So I like to share that with the Al-Anons. By the way, history tells us there were three groups of adult children of alcoholics, and they didn't like each other because they thought they invented the program. One was a pay-for-profit counseling thing. One applied to Al-Anon to come under that umbrella. Al-Anon didn't want anything to do with them. There was another group in California, and they were having their first world conference. And they asked me to be a speaker at this fundraiser. So I was supposed to be at this Shriner Auditorium at 5 o'clock on this particular day when I was going to speak at 8, and then there was going to be a dance. And the people I'm... Now, these are adult children, right? The people I'm corresponding with and talking to on the phone, be sure to be there at 5. Because there are 11 people on the committee and we're going to have dinner with you. So one time I was early. I'm there at 4:45. At 5, there's nobody in this huge parking lot. At 5:20, the parking lot is empty. About 5:30, a couple of cars pull up and they park as far away from me as they can. And they're not looking for anybody, you know. And I didn't have anything to do, so I walked over and I said, by the way, do you know anything about a function here for adult children of Alcoholics Anonymous? And one of the guys says, yes. And I thought he'd say something else, but he didn't. And I said, do you know anybody involved in that? He said, yes. I said, well, I'm the speaker tonight. I'm supposed to meet the committee. And he said, we're all on the committee. I know I'm with aliens. So, we got up, I think, to 9 people, and one of the gals said, "You think we ought to go eat?" So it took them 5 minutes to solve that problem. Then we go to this Chinese restaurant that's closed. And they stood in that parking lot for a long time. And finally someone said, "Do you think we ought to find another restaurant?" "Oh." So we went to this Italian place. Now, I know there are 2 committee members that don't know where we are. And toward the end of that meal, someone said, "Oh, you know, Barbara and Jack don't know where we are." I'm thinking, "Oh, my God." You know, I had a posse ready to go look for them in my head. And when I gave that talk that night, you're laughing at certain places that I expect you to laugh. They didn't laugh at those places. And some places that weren't funny at all, they just laughed and roared. And I said something, you know, when you're a speaker sometimes and you're stumbling, you say things you don't know you're going to say. So I got a little cocky. I said, "This is the ego showing up. You know, there's a dance here tonight. I hereby give all of you official permission to enjoy yourself at the dance." Kind of a smart-ass remark. I usually don't, because of my age as much as anything else, I usually don't hang around for dances. I did that night. I had 10 or 12 people come up to me and thank me profusely for giving them permission to enjoy them. I had no idea that meant so much to them. It was like someone reached inside of these kids and ripped out something they need to be human. And that's what happened. It was called alcoholism. But the pain that adult children have, the pain that spouses have, and the pain that alcoholics have are all different. They're subcultures. The steps in recovery is the same, but the subcultures differ. I can prove it to you. Suppose I'm supposed to give a talk that night to a group of alcoholics, and I'm there at 5 o'clock, half of the committee's there, scanning the parking lot with binoculars, you know, looking for the speaker, talking about the people who are late. Yeah. We'd pile into the cars, go to the Chinese restaurant, find out it was closed, burn the goddamn thing down. Suppose it was a group of Al-Anons. I show up 15 minutes early, they're all there. Plus the 2 alternates that they've appointed in case someone gets sick. They'd know the Chinese restaurant was closed. They'd have maps to the right place. They'd have emergency numbers to call if they get lost. You see how the subcultures are different? Okay. And thank God all 3 of those groups are recovering. That committee knows I talk this way about them. It's a great lesson for me. If there's anything I've learned about spirituality, it's paradoxical. Spirituality works backwards. I'll prove it to you. If you really internalize and own the truth in step 1, that you're powerless, not kind of powerless, but powerless over alcohol, and your life is unmanageable, and you don't know anything about the rest of the steps, the logical step 2 would be suicide. Right? That's not step 2. Step 2 is full of hope. And we don't see the growth in ourselves, but we see it in other people if we keep going to meetings. What a miracle. And I beg you, new people, keep going to meetings and ask questions and hang out with the people ahead of time and afterwards. I'm always asked to... there are 4 editions of the big book. The first 164 pages, the basic text is the same. They drop stories from the second half of the book is all stories. They drop some of those and they add new ones. The first ones, and AA's published a book. Somebody remember the name of it? Experience, Strength, and Hope, that has all the stories that they dropped. Most of the stories that they dropped for the second edition was because the people relapsed and they yanked their stories. There's a lot of relapse early on. We take continued sobriety for most people for granted. And in the second or third edition, or maybe both, there was a wonderful story that's not in the present edition called The Professor and the Paradox. A paradox, as you know, is something that works backwards. It looks like it wouldn't work, and it does. And he lists four paradoxes. We suffer to get well. We die to live. What are we dying to? Our old ideas. We give away to keep. We surrender to win. Those are all things that work backwards. And there are a lot of paradoxes in the program. That's what I've learned most about. And spiritual writers have been telling us for years that God writes straight with crooked lines. And there's another scripture phrase that's kind of like that, and I forget it. It's probably with the instructions for the steam iron. Okay. You know, I've been sober 38 years. Much of what we learn here, we don't know we learn. I've been to thousands of AA and Al-Anon meetings. I've never heard any, this is my experience, I've never heard anybody in any of those meetings tell anybody else how they have to believe in a higher power. Whew! Where else do you find a spiritual program where they don't tell you how to believe? Because we intuitively respect the freedom of the newcomer. We don't label them. We don't tell them how to believe in God. Isn't that amazing? What a paradox that is. One more story. If I leave this out, some people are going to be mad at me. One day, a man called me. He was kind of a... In Arizona, they have referees. They're kind of like a junior judge that settles things out of court. And this guy called me, and he was one of those people. And I knew him. He was a prissy Presbyterian Sunday school teacher. He could have been any other religion, but that's what he was. And he said, I hope you have time to talk to me. I said, yeah, sure, I'm glad to call. He said, now, I'm not an alcoholic. That's clue number one. Okay, I'm only going to talk 3 more minutes. He said, but listen to what he said next and all the qualifiers. He said, I'd like to talk to you about alcoholism and recovery, and I'm shortening this up, because I'm beginning to suspect that perhaps someday I might have a little problem with alcohol. I'm beginning to suspect that perhaps someday I might have a teeny little problem with alcohol. Man, I know he's an alcoholic. And he said, could you teach me a little bit about recovery? I said, yeah, sure. In fact, I'm going to have lunch with some people who know a lot about that. Would you go to lunch with me? He said, sure. I couldn't believe it. He said, yes. He said, oh, wait, that's not an AA meeting. I said, yeah, as a matter of fact, it is. It's called the lunch ones. He said, but I'm not an alcoholic. And I lied. I said, I'll tell everybody you're not an alcoholic. You're doing research. So I hung up on him. I called 3 lawyers in the program. I said, hey, we got a new one. He's in your profession. Can you be at the lunch bunch at noon? They all agreed. And I show up for lunch with my newcomer. None of those lawyers showed up. I am furious. I've got a triple resentment. But Red was there. This is the story I always have to tell because people crucify me if I don't. And Red was the old-time stereotypical idea of what a biker was. You know, he'd heard of bathing. Red liked to talk, and he only knew one verb. And it rhymes with duck. I've got the Sunday school teacher with me, and the topic of the meeting was, utilize the program, don't analyze it. That's good advice, new people. Utilize it. Do what people suggest. And that was a great topic. And I, you know what I'm doing? I'm sitting there with this resentment, and I'm praying Red not get called on. You know what happened? They called on Red. And he said, you know, some people are too smart to get this simple program. People who are really intellectual have a hard time. I'll prove it. Ben Franklin was an intellectual. And Ben Franklin believed that a good bowel movement was better than sex. And I've since found out that Ben Franklin said that. I can't look at my newcomer. And but Red isn't finished. He said, now, either I don't know how to shit or Ben didn't know how to fuck. But that's not the best part. The best part is I get in the car. This guy's sitting as far away from me as he can. And he's looking straight ahead, and in a mechanical voice, he says, "Thank you very much for taking me to that Alcoholics Anonymous meeting." I said, "You're welcome." And then he kind of looked toward me, his voice softened, he kind of scooched over, he said, "Could you take me to another one?" Here's the best part. He said, "Maybe one where Red goes." True story. I don't know how Red touched this guy's heart. It wasn't the Ben Franklin thing, I don't think. They started going to meetings together. After 2 weeks, this lawyer's admitting he's an alcoholic, and last I knew, he had more than a year of sobriety. So what do I know? The God of my experience is a God of surprises. The bigotry takes this form today. If people do something a little different, like what I did with the fifth chapter at meetings, I get a little upset. And in Colorado Springs, I do retreats twice a year for recovering people. I always go to a 5 o'clock meeting. And they identify themselves by name and addiction. You know, I'm Barbara, I'm an alcoholic. I'm George, I'm an Al-Anon. I'm Fred, I'm a drug addict. And we get to this one guy, and he says, "My name's Sylvester, and I'm an alcoholic growing along spiritual lines." And I'm thinking, well, isn't that cute? And I have another friend in Santa Cruz. He used way too many drugs. He speaks without transitions between subjects. You know? And his name's Leon. And Leon has a standard way of answering the question, "How you doing?" I say, "Hi, Leon, how you doing?" He said, "I'm right on schedule." So he would upset me with that thing, too. So I'm Gavin, an alcoholic growing along spiritual lines, and I'm right on schedule. And so are you. Thanks.